but that's the old me. Shouting out of my window, drove down, 'cause I don't care anymore. Said I don't care.
News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I'm your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great Saturday. Hope we can make your Saturday even just a little bit better by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. We're going to be kind of freewheeling this week. Usually, first of all, let me introduce my friend who joins me so very often on this show from the Pop Culture Analyst channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
Glad to be here. We do. We have more topics than time. We're just going to kind of ping around and hit as many things as we can, but I want to circle back around to a conversation you and I were having just right before we started, and that was big actors, big celebrities in movies, and how that can like either make or break a film. And the example that I came up with was Harry Styles in The Eternals, and it kind of opened up a conversation. So what do you think about having a celebrity in a movie that's almost so big that they jeopardize overtaking whatever is in the movie?
Well, let's first say what initially spawned that topic of conversation, which was the heavily rumored, possibly confirmed notion that Taylor Swift has been meeting with Marvel.
Which is wild to me, Julio. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, here's the thing. It's been rumored for a long time. It was rumored back when the X-Men were still at Fox. Like, the big rumor has always been that she's going to play Dazzler, which Dazzler is okay. A singer. So, you know, it would make some sense. There'd be some synergy there. That was kind of how Dazzler was created initially, was that there was going to be this synergistic character that appeared in comics but also made pop music. So,
interesting.
You know, if you're going to pick a character for Taylor Swift to play, that ain't a bad choice. And I think some of that recently has been pretty heavily rumored because Taylor Swift is very good friends with Ryan Reynolds. And I think more so with his wife, Blake Lively, but they hang out. Like, Ryan and Blake have been spotted at Chiefs games cheering on Travis Kelce with Taylor, that sort of thing. And that's a whole nother issue now, but we won't even get into that. We got into that a little bit last week. So there's been pretty heavy rumors of a Taylor cameo in Deadpool and Wolverine.
A cameo I could probably manage, especially in the context of Deadpool and Wolverine. But my question, like, doesn't it just become a Taylor Swift movie and not a Dazzler movie or something?
Well, I mean, from that, you went to the example of Harry Styles in The Eternals, and that's all that is a cameo. It's a cameo in a post-credit scene.
Yeah, but it was Harry Styles to me, and maybe that just speaks more to the way that I view movies, but I've always, and it's not like Robert Downey Jr. was a huge star, there's no question about it, but since then, they've casted people that were like moderately famous, but not like famous outside of the world of just simply being in movies.
I think it always depends on who the actor is and how they are in the role. If the actor is good enough in the role, they're going to win you over and you're going to forget that you're watching the actor. And the great example I always use of that, Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I forgot I was watching Jim Carrey in that movie.
And even Man on the Moon, another good example of him transitioning from being this very broad comedic actor to all of a sudden like doing more serious roles, like maybe when Adam Sandler did Punch Drunk Love or something.
Yeah, I mean, and at the time, Jim Carrey was one of the biggest stars in the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, whether, you know, they stay at that level or whatever, Harry Styles can act. Like, you know, it was not a good movie, but he held his own in Don't Worry, Darling against a pretty good cast. You know, the movie had its other issues, but the acting was not an issue in that, and he was not a problem with the acting in that movie. Remains to be seen if we're going to see his character again, because it's one of the 9 million lingering plot threads that are out there in the MCU.
One of the few major missteps that should have had big implications, but because the movie was very lukewarm in its reception, I think they kind of abandoned a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, there are certainly other examples of that going on in Marvel. You've got the end of Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness with Charlize Theron showing up as Clea. Great big star. Great big star. And I love Charlize, and I think she's great casting for that part. And it's somebody that can absolutely disappear into a part.
But does it change things if we're talking about pop stars going into movies? Like, we don't know if Taylor Swift can act. I assume she could. She's very talented.
Yeah, we do. She's been in 4 or 5 movies, putting aside her own music videos, some of which she's directed and played some pretty significant, like, acting in.
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, Taylor Swift's been in a bunch of movies. She was in Amsterdam last year. Was it Valentine's Day, I think, that Gary Marshall movie, one of those like Love Actually kind of movies for a holiday.
That makes sense. Yeah.
She's been in a half dozen movies probably easily. She can act. Like Harry Styles, I'm not handing her an Oscar tomorrow or anything, but you know, and Taylor wants an Oscar. An Oscar. I promise you. She's an ambitious person. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but the number of like, here's a song for your movie kind of situation that she's been in. She's gotten nominated, I think, once or twice, but she didn't even get nominated the last time she did one. And it was the Swifties were mad about that. It's funny because there's this whole thing that's, and we've gotten way off of where we were going to go with this topic, but it's fine. We had Billie Eilish dropped her new album this week.
Single is great.
First single is an absolute banger called Lunch. Oh my God, it's so good. In fact, we're going to play that when we come back from the break, because I am all here for Team Billie on that. So she's dropped this album, and she's been kind of pushing this album for a while, and she'd made some comments in the press about how she wasn't doing a bunch of variant editions of this album because she thinks it's wasteful, because you know, from an environmental standpoint, not knocking anybody for trying to be on the hustle or anything like that, but from an environmental standpoint, you know, she's made a point of like she's using all recycled materials in the album packaging, and the vinyl pressings are being made from recycled vinyl, and yada yada. This is her big thing, and so she'd made some comments about that she thinks it's unfair, or she thinks it's bad for the environment and a little unfair to fans to put out like 20 variant editions of the same album. Of course, a bunch of people took that as a knock on Taylor Swift, who does that. So,
and I think Billie Eilish came out and said that she's even done it in the past, but that she's just kind of looking at things differently.
She has, and she also came back out and said, hey, look, this wasn't meant to be a knock on anybody in particular, yada, yada. She's had this big push for this album, and they've been hyping it for a while. She made a point of not releasing any singles in advance. She wanted people to get the whole album at once. The album comes out after, 3-4 weeks of Taylor Swift's latest album being at the top of the charts. You'd like to have the number one album when you're a big artist like Billie Eilish. So Taylor drops 2 more variant editions of her Tortured Poets, whatever it's called, album this week. And I'm not saying that to be dismissive. I just don't remember the album title. So, as Billie Eilish's album comes out, Taylor Swift says, oh, here's a couple more variant editions of my album. Go get them, Swifties.
Enjoy.
So it becomes this thing of, was that done to keep Billie Eilish out of the number one spot? Could Taylor have waited a week or released him a week earlier? And, they're supposed to be, at least friendly. So I don't know. But
go for lunch.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Taylor Swift is the biggest star in the world. So I get to round it back around to what you were bringing up. Yeah. There's an impact of Taylor Swift being on the screen. That's always going to be, oh, look, it's Taylor Swift. That's kind of like, in Jay and Silent Bob, when Mark Hamill shows up and the movie literally stops and it comes up on the screen and says, look, kids, it's Mark Hamill.
Yeah.
It's without doing that, it's kind of doing that a little bit. But if it's the right role and she's good in it, it's going to be fine. And I want to run it back real quick, because you said it's not like she's Keanu Reeves and Dracula, and I will go to bat for Keanu and Dracula. Keanu may be the weak link in that movie, but look at who he's up against, man. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
I could She dances on my tongue, tastes like she might be the one. And I could never get enough, I could buy her so much stuff. It's a craving, not a crush.
Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Analysis channel on YouTube. And man, that's such a banger.
Billie Eilish, clearly in her box lunch fades.
Oh.
You'll get that one tomorrow.
Oh, man. it's such a great song, man. I am just here for that. I could listen to that on repeat for a week. And yeah, it's a little risque, but that's
I'm
okay.
Into it. The video is also super cool. It looks like it was shot with one of those like 90s consumer grade digital cameras. Super cool, man. I'm a big fan. I've always liked Billie Eilish, and to me, this seems like her most pop and her most like upbeat. I mean, you know, Bad Guy's a very big song, but there's kind of like a dark undercurrent to that one, and this feels like Billie Eilish coming out and having fun and doing like an upbeat song. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah. It's still got a little bit of that darkness to it. And that's one of the things I appreciate about the music that she does. She works with her brother, Phineas, who's her producer, and they write together. And, basically on the new album, it's really mostly just the two of them from what I understand. I haven't heard the whole album yet, but looking at the liner notes online, the two of them basically played everything except for a couple of string parts.
I didn't know that was unusual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it can be, you know, sometimes, you know, a lot of times you'll hire musicians to, you know, play, you know, you maybe one person's a guitarist and then you hire a drummer and a bass player or whatever.
Sure. Yes.
But in
general, I thought they always did that. So that's news to me.
No, not necessarily. It just depends. But in this case, yeah, I mean, Billie Eilish is obviously the vocalist and she plays keyboards. And then Phineas is playing pretty much all of the other instruments. With the exception of they, you know, brought in a couple of session violinist, viola, that sort of thing for a song or two that have some strings on them. So yeah, I mean, you know, two very creative, you know, still very young people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I think that they deserve everything that's come to them. You know, they've won a lot of awards. I think Billie Eilish is the youngest person to ever win two Oscars, maybe.
Wild.
Yeah, certainly, you know, and interesting to think about the fact, like, she's got two Oscars. Alfred Hitchcock never won an Oscar in his life.
Huh.
Danny Elfman, if you want to keep it to just music, Danny Elfman has never won an Oscar.
That's unbelievable to think about when you think about the amount of impact that he's had from themes and movies to The Simpsons television series. And what about Oingo Boingo? Did they ever win anything?
No, I mean, Oingo Boingo were relatively obscure outside of, they were huge in California and like the rest of the country, other than, you know, having, I think that they're a band whose legend has grown over time and now they have an audience. But like while they were actually together, they were pretty obscure.
Huh. And Dead Man's Party is one of my favorites.
Well, and I think it's that thing of they showed up and they were used in so many movies. And in fact, even just showed up in a couple of movies because they were so big in Southern California.
Sure.
So they were right there in Hollywood and, you know, directors, producers, stars saw them and like them and put them, put their music or put them in their movies, but they never really broke big in the rest of the country. And I think over time, from those songs being so, certain songs being so prominent, Dead Man's Party being one, Weird Science being another, a couple of others that have been in various movies, Bachelor Party, Back to School, of course, Weird Science. But you know, there's about a half dozen like pretty well-known films from that era that used Oingo Boingo music or Oingo Boingo actually appeared in. And I think it's that, those movies getting replayed on cable years and years and years and becoming kind of cult favorites that has increased Oingo Boingo's legend over the years. But I mean, there are so many great Oingo Boingo songs that people don't know because they weren't used in movies, and people only know those like couple of songs that were in movies. And if you were, and I was a fan back then, if you were a fan and you go deeper into the catalog, and I might play something when we come back from the next break to kind of illustrate that, because there's an Oingo Boingo song I really, really love that isn't one of their, I would say, five or six best known songs. Sure. And it's a little moodier than some of the stuff you might think of when you think of Oingo Boingo. That you're just giving me an excuse to play it.
I'm into that.
But yeah, I mean, and I also think that Danny Elfman becoming prominent as a film composer also increased the legend of Oingo Boingo.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And just kind of took that in a different route than anybody was expecting. So it's a weird situation now where, like, I think there's a lot more demand for Oingo Boingo's music than there was at the time. And he has taken to, he does these small tours every once in a while now where he does some of the Oingo Boingo music and he does some of his orchestral music and some of his TV themes and something. Like, I'm dying to see one of these shows, man. Next time he does it, I'm traveling for it. Cause I'm just here for that. Other than the guitarist from Oingo Boingo kind of came over with him and has been his musical director, for lack of a better term. If you know anything about composing, there's somebody that works on the score with a composer want to say they're called an orchestrator, if I'm remembering the term correctly. That kind of then takes the basic thing and fleshes it out and brings in all the other parts and that sort of thing. So
maybe what Atticus Ross is to Trent Reznor when Trent Reznor composes?
Sort of, but Atticus Ross is credited as a co-composer.
Okay.
So in this case, an orchestrator is not necessarily considered a co-composer. And John Williams has somebody he uses. You know, everybody's got somebody they use. And I cannot remember for the life of me the guy's name who's the guitarist in Oingo Boingo, and has
somebody
gone on.
Knows. Let us know.
Yeah. Well, I'll look it up during the break, but he has been Danny Elfman's musical director for all this time. You know, he's worked on his scores as an orchestrator. And now when he's doing these tours, this guy's like the band leader. He's the one that, is in charge of all the musicians and, helps put together the musical side of the stage show, et cetera, et cetera. So you got those two guys off on one side. And the other remaining members of Oingo Boingo have been recently touring under the name former members of Oingo Boingo.
Oh, that's funny.
They've got, somebody else singing, obviously, because Danny Elfman was the vocalist in Oingo Boingo, if you don't know, in addition to being the main songwriter and the leader of the band. Obviously they've had to find somebody else to sing, but there is a touring version mostly that does like these big 80s nostalgia shows and does some shows in California and things like that called the former members of Oingo Boingo. And so you got those two things out there. And I kind of just wish, guys, just make nice. Go just
oh,
do
is it contentious?
Do a tour. I don't think it's contentious even. I don't even think it's a situation where there's like any bad feelings or anything like that. I mean, maybe there's some, but certainly not in any kind of big publicized ways, like some of the ones you could name, like, the Smiths or the Talking Heads or something like that. Although even Talking Heads have been, you know, at least doing a couple of interviews together lately. Still want them to, let's have a reunion tour from the Talking Heads. Come on, David. Come on.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I know you're out there doing Paramore covers right now, but
yeah. What?
And no, I'm not lying about that. David Byrne just not too long ago released a Paramore cover. He did a cover of Hard Times.
Oh, I got to hear that.
Yeah, so here's how I think this came about. I don't know for sure, but the A24, which did the big remaster and re-release of the Talking Heads concert film Stop Making Sense late last year. Great film. Got to see it in theater. It was awesome. But they, in conjunction with doing that, put together a tribute album to that album where they got a bunch of current acts to do the songs that appear on that live album. One of the acts on that album was Paramore, who did Burning Down the House, which they did a great version of it. A legit, really good version of it. It's not too far afield from the original, but you know, it's got that groove. It's got Hayley Williams' voice on it, and it sounds really good. So I kind of think that Byrne did the Paramore cover as kind of a thank you for doing the Talking Heads album. But he did a fun little cover of Hard Times. Maybe we'll play that too. We'll do that. We've got our songs for the next two segments now. But yeah, so David Byrne's out there dropping Paramore covers instead
of. I'm such a big fan of Hayley Williams. Like, she's just such an incredibly charismatic vocalist and just always seems like she's having such a good time at shows.
Yeah. You know, I've been one of those people that kind of was like, Paramore can take them or leave them. But I've like kind of started coming around in the last couple of years. Like, I mean, I like that song, Hard Times, and there's a couple other songs that are more recent that I really, really like. And they kind of made a turn somewhere in there where they were, they kind of came up in that emo wave.
Right, yeah. And I was the same way, kind of dismissive when they first came out.
Yeah, but they kind of have made more of a pop turn. And not just more of a pop turn, but like a real like 80s influenced pop turn. And that's what I kind of dig. You know, I'm kind of here for that. So, but yeah, I mean, I guess then you bring it full circle, doing a cover of Burning Down the House makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, you don't, that is an 80s pop song. We got to take a break, man. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. And AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. No, your ears are not deceiving you. That is David Byrne, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, former member of the Talking Heads, doing a Paramore cover. Yeah, that happened. I told you it happened, and I backed it up with the proof. There it is. David Byrne doing Hard Times by Paramore. What do you think, Jeremy?
Eh. It's all right. It's a very Talking Heads version of Hard Times. I prefer the original, but that shouldn't come as a shock. Do you like it?
I think it's a bop, man.
It's all right. Yeah.
I'm here for it. You know, I like the original too, but yeah, I'm a big David Byrne fan. I'm a big Talking Heads fan, so doing that kind of style on it. And I can see, you know, we did a little research on this, and apparently I am right. It did come about from Paramore covering Burning Down the House for the Stop Making Sense tribute album, and they kind of became friendly in the course of that. Paramore apparently said that this song was influenced by the Talking Heads. And that was what kind of sparked David Byrne doing it. So yeah, I mean, you know, you can hear it in that. I don't know if you hear it as much in the original version, but I think it goes back to what I was saying earlier about how Paramore's sound shifted over the years and kind of did start to have more of an 80s new wavy kind of influence to it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm much more here for that side of Paramore.
When we were talking in the first segment, the conversation about Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively came up in regard to Taylor Swift. We do talk about Marvel in particular quite a bit, but there's a couple X-Men news things that we wanted to touch on. One of them was kind of a change in dynamic from a conversation that we had last week, Julio. So what do you got there?
Yeah, you know, I had kind of implied that there had been some concern about the ratings for X-Men 97. But apparently either that concern has disappeared or there's been a turn and more people have been discovering the show, because it is now being considered certainly one of the most successful animated projects they've done at Disney Plus, but one of the more successful Marvel projects at Marvel at Disney Plus too. So it's very interesting. I'm glad to see that because the show's outstanding. You know, we talked about it for the whole show last week, so I don't want to go too far into it, but you know, it also puts them in this position of they fired the showrunner.
Yeah. Oops.
You know, and Beau DeMaio has been credited very much with being the driving force behind what's made the show so good. And of course, like, the comforting thing in everybody's minds has been, well, they didn't fire him until after he did all the writing for season two. And he has come out in the past week and said, yes, I did write or oversee all of these scripts. However, I won't be involved in all of the other parts that a showrunner is involved in, including rewrites, including overseeing the animation, including, you know, all these other things that he was part of for season one. So, there's still a question mark in there, and we know we're still going to have some time before we get season two, because the executive producer of the show came out and basically said, people are just going to have to be patient with us. Animation
while
takes
we're
time.
On the topic of showrunners, and this is a trailer that dropped just this week. House of the Dragons got a new trailer out, and in a similar kind of twist of the knife to fans of that series, the showrunner is actually departed that as well after season one. So how do you think these shows are going to do without the creative minds that were driving them?
I hadn't heard that on House of the Dragon.
I'm trying to think of his name right now. It's not Miguel Sapochnik. That's the composer. But the guy that was the original showrunner, he was the one that kind of came over from Game of Thrones, had been involved in directing the best episodes, like Battle of the Bastards, Winds of Winter, all of the best episodes of Game of Thrones, critically received. And, before this first season was even over, he was parted ways with him over creative differences.
Now, you had the right name. It was Miguel Sapochnik was the showrunner on season one.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I don't know. We'll see. You know, a lot of the same people are still involved, so it just depends. I don't know. A lot of people wondered about House of the Dragon not being run by the guys that ran Game of Thrones, and it turned out just fine so far. So we'll see.
Do you think series like House of the Dragon and X-Men are just too big to fail?
I mean, it could be. We'll see. You know, it's certainly not the first shows that have undergone changes in showrunners, and sometimes it has a big effect and sometimes it doesn't.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I can definitely think of examples where there was a noticeable drop off of quality when a showrunner changed hands. And the two that come immediately to my mind, first of all, Castle. I was a big fan of that show for the first several seasons. And there were some other reasons why it fell off at the end. But when the showrunner left, the quality dipped, and then some other stuff happened. And it was a show that kind of went out with a whimper instead of a bang, unfortunately. Another great example is Gilmore Girls, created by Amy Sherman Palladino, who, of course, has gone on to great success with The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and other things. And she and her husband, Daniel Palladino, were the showrunners. And then the last season, I think it was a money situation, and they were kind of forced out the door. And the last season of Gilmore Girls, of the original series, is not as good as the rest of the seasons. Then they came back and did The Year in the Life on Netflix, and those were great. Another great example.
Bring back the original showrunner?
Yeah. Another great example is Community.
That is a good example.
To the extent that they wrote a whole season off as everybody being under the influence of a gas leak. And that season was the season that was not run by the creator of the show, Dan Harmon. So, yeah, there are cases where a change in showrunner can be a dramatic fall off. There are cases where it can be an improvement. Yeah, we just don't know. We won't know until it happens. But I'm still kind of on team bring back Beau DeMayo.
Yeah.
And we'll see.
If what we know is what is the extent of it, then I agree.
Yeah. But we had some live-action X-Men news this week as well. We've got the news that they have hired a screenwriter for the potential next X-Men live-action movie. What that's going to look like, where that's going to fall and everything, all that, we don't know any of that yet. We know that Marvel has the X-Men back now, because obviously Disney bought Fox. We know that, and I mean, I guess technically you can say Deadpool and Wolverine is the first X-Men movie that's being produced by Marvel. Kinda. But I mean, this is going to be at some point a movie that's going to have X-Men in the name of it. And we don't know where that falls in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or this is going to be somewhere in the multiverse, if it's going to be connected. We don't know any of that. We don't know who's going to direct it.
Is Michael Leslie, and he is the writer behind the Hunger Games series. You got thoughts on that?
Not the entire series. He is the writer behind the prequel that came out late last year.
Oh, well, that changes things.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. Apparently, this guy is the guy that gets hired to revive franchises, because his next film is a third Now You See Me.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which it's been a while since we've seen one of those movies, and the second one was kind of not as well received as the first. But there's some buzz about that. And, of course, Hunger Games were originally three books that they made into four movies, because for a while there you had to make the last book into two movies. It was just the law.
Yeah.
They would arrest you if you didn't. And, now he's going to be the guy that is at least going to write the first draft of whatever becomes the next X-Men movie. Where that ends up going, we don't know. We know how things happen with projects. Sometimes people start out on something and they don't go with it. I don't know, man. I don't know what to think. I thought that the Hunger Games prequel was all right. I thought it was a decent movie. I think it was a little long. I think there was stuff that could have been cut out on it. I also think that my opinion of that movie was a little lower than a lot of other people's opinion of that movie was.
I actually didn't see it.
Yeah. I recommend seeing it. It's not bad, and the acting's good in it and all of that. It's got some decent action, and it's got some fun stuff in it. I was not as hip on it as the people that I saw it with, who are usually harder movie critics than me. So that's interesting. Interesting way to look at it in and of itself. So I don't know. I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other about what this guy's going to bring to the X-Men. I hope he brings something great. Hope they remember it's an ensemble and not Wolverine and
Agreed.
But we'll see. We got to take a break. Back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Hey! is Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. I just wanted to make good on my promise earlier to you to play one of the deeper cuts from Oingo Boingo, although that was a single, so I don't know how deep a cut it is, but it is a deeper cut probably in the general mainstream audience. That song's called Stay. And
one I was a big fan of.
I really love that song. Yeah, I'm here for that. I'm here for Oingo Boingo in general, but I really like that song. But it's so funny, you know, we at the top of the show, we told you we didn't really have like set segments like we do a lot of the times. Like a lot of times we plan, okay, we're going to talk this first segment about nothing but this one thing. And we had a list like where we wanted the conversation to go. That list has just gone out the window because we ended up talking about went off into Oingo Boingo and Billie Eilish and just all this, you know, Taylor Swift and, you know, God knows what else we ended up talking about rather than what we intended to talk about. So we tried to get it back on track. We talked a little bit about X-Men, talked a little bit about House of the Dragon. Wanted to talk about some Star Trek news that came out this week. And I know, Jeremy, you're not the biggest Star Trek guy in the world. I'm a much bigger Star Trek guy than you are, but you know, it's been interesting lately because, you know, we're in the home stretch of Star Trek Discovery, which has, I think, as we're talking today, by the time this airs, it'll only have one more episode left. The next last episode's dropping this week. Last episode will drop next week. We've gotten the announcement that Star Trek Lower Decks is going to come to an end this season. We do know Strange New Worlds is continuing on. We've been in this weird waiting game for a movie for some time now. And there's been some news about that, too, that ties into the X-Men also, interestingly enough. But we have had this buzz about a new Star Trek series coming up, which is going to be titled Starfleet Academy. As the name implies, it takes place at Starfleet Academy, so you're going to see a lot of young cadets and that sort of thing. It's going to take place in the far future Discovery era, which is far ahead of any other Star Trek series that's currently on the air in terms of the time period it takes place in. But we've got the announcement this week that they have cast the captain and chancellor of the school. And it's a name that people are going to be very, very familiar with. And that is none other than Academy Award winner Holly Hunter.
Big fan.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited about this. It's pretty rare that there are Oscar winners associated with Star Trek. Probably most notably Michelle Yeoh, who was on Star Trek Discovery in the early seasons before going on to win her Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once. And now we know is coming back to Star Trek. They are doing a Section 33 movie, which is like the Black Ops division of Starfleet, that is going to star Michelle Yeoh and bring back her character. They're doing that for that. It's a movie, but it's being done for Paramount Plus. So it's not a theatrical film. You know, of course, probably most memorably, Whoopi Goldberg joined the cast of Star Trek The Next Generation in a recurring role after winning an Academy Award for Ghost. You had F. Murray Abraham, who won for Amadeus, and then played a role in Star Trek Insurrection, the third Next Generation film, if I'm remembering correctly. So there's been a couple, but it's still rare, especially for somebody that's so prominent as Holly Hunter, not just an Academy Award winner, but also a multiple nominee. She was nominated three other times. And just
one of them was for Batman versus Superman, if I remember correctly.
No, you're not going to serve me granny sweet tea here.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, that was not one of the films she was nominated for. I don't believe that it was the Snyder Bronies that got her cast in Star Trek. I just have a feeling. And full credit, Snyder Bronies is a term that I've stolen from the website Bleeding Cool. They use that the Snyder stands is probably the best way to put it, but Snyder Bronies is just funnier.
It's good.
At any rate, Holly Hunter coming to Star Trek. You have any thoughts about that?
I mean, you couldn't do much better as far as just a really high caliber actor. I think that, you know, kind of bringing somebody notable who doesn't have a history in Star Trek will hopefully bring in some new audiences, because I do feel, you know, and I kind of joked with you before we started, but I do feel that Star Trek even continues to niche down and to get more specific to the people who are already fans. J.J. Abrams did a pretty good job of trying to open it up and make it a much more mainstream and accessible to new audience type thing. So I think anything they can do to get new eyes on the property would be a really good thing. And bringing in somebody like Holly Hunter, who was just acclaimed, might, you know, help do that.
I'm just wanting the Star Trek Raising Arizona crossover that we've all been thinking of for so long.
Oh, I'd be a big fan of that.
Oh, I would too. I'm a huge fan of Raising Arizona, and she's so good in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
If we could just get just a little hint of Ed in her performance, I'm here for that. I just want to see that like Southern accent has lasted into the, I think it's the 32nd century that Discovery takes place in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I want to see if that accent has maintained into the 32nd century. I'm here for that.
While we're on the Raising Arizona topic, did you know Nick Cage is starring in a live-action Spider-Noir series that's coming to Amazon Prime?
I did, and it's interesting that he's doing this right after he said he wasn't interested in playing superheroes.
Sounds about right, though, doesn't
it? It does. It does. But I mean, yeah, he did play the character in the Spider-Verse films, and assumingly is going to play the character again in the third film, because that character is coming back in the third film. So,
and what a standout character!
Yeah. So I mean, I think it makes some sense. I'll be interested to see how they play the character in a live-action setting in that world, because they obviously had a little bit of fun with that character in the animated films. Versus if they go more of a true to the comics route with that, like that hard boiled, like kind of like self narration that the character did in the movie.
Sure.
I mean, that's part of noir films, and it was played kind of for laughs in the animated film, but they can play that totally straight in a live action series and have it work too.
What would you prefer?
I kind of want to see him play it straight. I'd love to see just a straight noir story. That would be kind of fun.
It would. I agree. I think because of expectations, they'll probably go the more satirical route, but I would be in for either way. I like your idea that they do take it straight, though.
Yeah. Going back to Star Trek for just a minute, I mentioned that there was some news there related to the X-Men. And that is that they have hired Simon Kinberg, who was, of course, the producer on most of the X-Men movies. And for better or for worse, the director of Dark Phoenix. Also, for better or for worse, the producer of Fanforestick.
Love it.
Yeah, they have hired him to produce a Star Trek film, a theatrical Star Trek film. This is not the fourth film in the J.J. Abrams series, however. That is still flying around out there as a possibility of someday we're going to get this, and I'll believe it when there's a trailer in front of me. But that's still off there. This is supposed to be a movie about the origins of the Star Trek universe and the first meeting of humans and aliens, which I don't understand because we've seen in Trek a couple of times already, but you know, okay, whatever. I don't know if this is going to take place in the same series as in the same time period as the series Enterprise, which covered a lot of this stuff too. I don't know if this is an Enterprise movie, and maybe we're going to see Scott Bakula and company back. There's still a lot of what is this kind of out there, but they did release the news. They've hired Simon Kinberg.
I mean, you mentioned some of the highlights and some of the lowlights of his career. I do think he's had his hands in some pretty good properties and good projects. So I like the idea of that, and as somebody who's a casual, that sounds like a fun place to explore, but as a fan, it seems like you feel it might even be a little bit of a retread of things you've already seen.
I mean, yeah, and the dude, yeah, okay, he was the producer on First Class, which is outstanding. He's a producer on Days of Future Past, which is a good movie. He's a producer on Deadpool. not arguing with Deadpool. But he also came into the franchise with Last Stand. So this dude was behind both bad versions of the Dark Phoenix saga.
Yeah.
So that's like, okay, well, you know, it's like the whole, and this is another one that you could tie to Star Trek. It's like Akiva Goldsman. When Akiva Goldsman is good, he's really good. He won an Oscar for Writing a Beautiful Mind. When Akiva Goldsman is bad, it's Batman and Robin.
Yeah, there's a bit of producers out there. Is Avi Arad another one of those guys?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, you know, was involved in a lot of the early Marvel stuff too. So, I mean, you know, what can I say? Well, all we can say is we'll see what happens. At this point, we don't even know if they'll end up being a movie. So,
yeah.
You know, we've got some time to figure that out. And when we do figure it out, we'll be talking about it here on the show. We are done for this week. We had so many other things we wanted to get to. We'll try to get to them next week. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3. and AM 1620. We hope you've had a good time, and we can't wait to talk to you again next week. We'll see you then. Have a great weekend.